Sergio Caporetti leaned over the railing of the bridge, blowing long streamers of blue cheroot smoke from mouth and nostrils to help foul a morning which was already thick and grey with sea fret. The islands of Thunderbolt and Suicide were blanketed by the mist, but the surf broke against their hidden cliffs like distant artillery, and the seabirds' voices were plaintive and small lost souls in the void. Wild Goose came bustling up out of the mist, swinging in under Kingfisher's side to hover there under power, with two of her crew fending off. Hugo Kramer stuck his white blonde head out of the wheelhouse window and shouted up at the deck, "Okay, boss, come on." Sergio watched the tall figure on Kingfisher's deck rouse and look around like a man waking from sleep. Johnny Lance lifted his head and looked up at the bridge, and Sergio noticed that he was unshaven. A new beard darkened his jaw and emphasized its prominence. He looked as though he had not slept, and he hunched into the windbreaker with the collar turned up against the mist. He did not smile, but lifted one hand in farewell salute to Sergio, who noticed incongruously that the index finger was missing from the hand. Somehow that pathetic little detail struck Sergio. He was sorry, truly sorry. But there is always a loser in every game, and £25,000 is a lot of money. Good luck, Johnny. Thanks, Sergio. Johnny went to the rail, lugging his briefcase, and swung over it. He dropped swiftly down the steel rungs set in Kingfisher's hull, and jumped the narrow gap of surging water to Wild Goose's deck. The trawler's engine bellowed, and she pulled away, rounding onto a course for Cartridge Bay. Johnny Lance stood on her open deck, looking back at Kingfisher. "He a good guy," Sergio shook his head with regret. "He's a boss," the helmsman grunted. "No boss is any good."
"Hey, you, I also a boss," Sergio challenged him.
"Like I said," the helmsman suppressed a grin.
"I kiss your mother."
Sergio insulted him with dignity, then changed the subject.
"I go below now, I take over."
Sergio opened the door to the control room with the duplicate key. He closed the door behind him, seated himself at the console, and took from his pocket a sheet of paper headed Kaminikoto Secondary Recovery Program. 10 minutes later, he came out of the control room and locked the door.
"Kami, I love you," he chuckled,
as he closed off the watertight doors that isolated this deck from the one above. He wound the locking bars into position to ensure that he was not interrupted by one of his own crew. From the tool cupboard on the bulkhead, he selected a pair of set spanners and went through into the conveyor room. It took him 20 minutes to unscrew the heavy, deeply threaded bolts that secured the hatch. It had been designed to resist easy entry, a deterrent to casual investigation, but at last Sergio could lift the steel plate off its seating. He eyed the small square opening with distaste, and reflexively sucked in his pendulous belly. The hatch had not been designed to afford passage to a man of his dimensions. He took off his cap and jacket and hung them on the cock of one of the pipes. Then he ground out his cheroot under his heel and brushed back the hair from his forehead with both hands, checked that his flashlight was in his pocket, and committed himself to the hatch. He wriggled and kicked and grunted and built up a heavy sweat for 5 minutes before he had squeezed through into the conveyor belt tunnel. He squatted on his haunches, panting heavily, and flashed his torch along the tunnel. Above his head, the conveyor belt carrying the gravel ran smoothly, but the residual heat from the dryers made it unbearably hot. He began to crawl rapidly to the end of the tunnel. From the inside, it was impossible to tell, without measuring, that the conveyor belt tunnel was shorter by 12 feet than the external length. The end of the tunnel was false, and beyond it was a secret cubicle only just large enough to house Kaminikoto's equipment, through which all the gravel passed on its journey to the X-ray room. The Japanese genius for miniaturization was demonstrated by the equipment in this secret cubicle. It was an almost exact copy of the sorting equipment in the main X-ray compartment, except that it had been scaled down to 1/10 of the size without affecting its efficiency. In addition, this miniature plant could discriminate in the diamonds it selected. It would not allow a stone over 4 carats to pass through, and it screened out fixed percentages of the smaller stones, allowing only a proportion of the smaller and less valuable diamonds to proceed through into the main X-ray room. It was an amazing piece of electronic engineering, but Sergio was unimpressed as he lay on his side in the cramped hot tunnel and began laboriously to unscrew another smaller plate in the false bulkhead. At last it was open, and he reached through the opening. After a few seconds of fiddling and groping and heavy breathing, he brought out a stainless steel cup with a capacity of about 2 pints. There were clamps on the cup to hold it in position, below the chute under Kaminakoto's machine. The metal cup was heavy, and Sergio placed it carefully on the deck beside him before propping himself on an elbow and shining the flashlight into the cup and took something out of it. Stared at it a moment, then dropped it back. "By the blood of all the martyrs," he gasped with shock, and then immediately contrite for his blasphemy, he crossed himself awkwardly with the hand holding the flashlight. Then again he shone the torch into the cup and shook his head in disbelief. Quickly he pulled a canvas drawstring bag from his pocket, and lying on his side he carefully poured the contents of the cup into the bag, drew the string tight and stuffed it back into his pocket, where it made a big hard bulge on his hip like a paper sack of rock candy. He clamped the stainless steel cup back into position, screwed the cover plate over the opening, and backed away down the tunnel on hands and knees. He very badly needed a cheroot. 4 hours later, Hugo Kramer shinned up the ladder onto Kingfisher's deck while his helmsman took the trawler down to leeward to wait for him. Sergio shouted down from the bridge, "Johnny, he has gone?"
"Yeah,"
Hugo shouted back. "He should almost be in Cape Town by now. The Beechcraft is a fast plane, huh?"
"Good. How did it go with you?"
Hugo countered.
"Come up. I'll show you."
Sergio led him into his cabin behind the bridge and locked the door carefully. Then he went to each of the portholes and drew the curtains across them before crossing to his desk and switching on the reading lamp.
"Sit down," Sergio indicated the chair opposite the desk. "You want a drink or something?"
"Come on," Hugo grated impatiently. "Stop mucking around. Let's have a look."
"Ah," Sergio looked at him sadly. "You Germans, you are always too much hurry. You cannot rest. Enjoy life. Cuts a crap."
Hugo's pale eyes were on his face, and Sergio was suddenly aware that this man was dangerous, like a tiger shark, coldly dangerous, without malice or passion. Sergio was surprised he had not noticed it before. "I must be careful with this one," he thought, and he unlocked the drawer of his desk and took out the canvas bag. He loosened the drawstring and poured the diamonds onto the blotter. The smallest was the size of a match head, perhaps 0.1 of a carat, and the poorest quality was black and granular-looking, ugly little industrial stones, for Cammy had been careful not to take out only the best and so distort the Kingfisher's recovery as to arouse suspicion. There were hundreds of these tiny crystals and chips, which would fetch a few pounds in the industrial market, but there were other stones in the full range of quality and shapes and sizes, as big as green peas or as marbles, and a few bigger than that. Some of them were perfect octahedron crystals, others water-worn, chipped, or amorphous in shape. They formed a dully glittering pile in the centre of the blotter, in all perhaps 500 diamonds, yet all of these were dwarfed by one single stone that lay in the centre of the pile, rising out of it the way Mount Everest rises from her foothills. There are freak diamonds so large or unusual that they become legends. Diamonds who have their own names and whose histories are recorded and invested with romance. The great paragons, stones of the first water, whose cut and finished weight exceed 100 metric carats. Africa has produced many of them. The Yonker diamond, a 726-carat rough cut to a brilliant of 125 carats that hangs about the throat of the Queen of Nepal. The Jubilee diamond, a superb 245-carat cushion of unearthly fire fashioned out of 650-carat rough. Then the biggest of them all, a monstrous rough stone of 3,106 carats, the Cullinan, which yield not one, but 2 paragons. The Great Star of Africa at 530 carats, and the Cullinan II at 317 carats. Both these stones grace the crown jewels of England. Now, on Sergio Caporetti's desk, lay a rough stone which would add yet another paragon to the list.
"Have you weighed it?"
asked Hugo, and Sergio nodded.
"How much?" 320 carats, Sergio said softly.
Jesus, whispered Hugo, and Sergio crossed himself quickly to dissociate from the use of names. Reverently, Hugo Cramer leaned forward and picked up the big diamond. It filled the palm of his hand. The cleavage plane that formed its base was smooth and clean as an axe stroke. There were bigger diamonds in history, but this diamond had a special feature which would set it in a niche of its own and endow it with peculiar value. Its colour was the serene blue of a high summer sky. This stone could pay half the total bill for Kingfisher's construction, if it were ever used for that purpose. Hugo replaced the blue diamond on the desk and lit a cigarette without taking his eyes from it.
This field, it is bigger, richer, far richer than we had guessed.
Sergio nodded.
In 3 days we have taken diamonds that I hope to see once in 5 years,
Hugo went on, as he began picking out the larger diamonds from the pile and laying them in a line across the desktop in approximate order of size, while Sergio opened his desk drawer and took out a box of his special occasion cheroots.
We must tell the boss, Hugo decided.
He began arranging the diamonds in a neat circle about the big blue, thinking deeply.
He must know how rich it is before he talks to Lance. He must make arrangements. He will know what to do. He is a clever one.
What about these? Sergio indicated the treasure on the desk. Are you going to take them off? Hugo hesitated.
No, he decided. We could never get rid of this big blue through the usual channel. It is too big, too distinctive. We will keep it aboard. When the boss takes over the company again, then we will just declare it all nice and legal. No trouble.
He stood up.
Look after them. I must hurry if I am to get a message to Cape Town in time.
The company bears my father's name, Mr. Larson. It's as simple as that. Benedict's voice was husky with emotion, and he looked down at his hands.
I have a duty to my father's memory.
My boy, well... Larson came to lay his hand on Benedict's arm.
But I just don't know what to say. Honour is a rare and precious thing these days.
With his free hand, he was groping almost frantically for the bell on the desk behind him. He must get this signed up solid before the youngster changed his mind.
I tried to warn you, Mr. Larson. My father and I never had any faith in this marine recovery scheme. Lance pushed it through.
Yes, yes, quite so, Larson agreed, and turned to his assistant, who came into the office at the trot in response to the bell.
Ah, Simon, the Van der Bijl diamond loan. Will you have an agreement made out immediately? Mr. Van der Bijl would like to take over the capital amounts and the outstanding interest as well.
By rolling his eyes, Larson tried to convey to his assistant the deadly urgency of the situation. The young man understood, and 15 minutes later laid the agreement on Larson's desk. Larson unscrewed the cap of his pen and handed it to Benedict. Larson and 3 of his young men ushered Benedict out through the glass doors of the bank and across the pavement to where the Rolls stood in the reserved parking bay in Adderley Street. Benedict settled into the back seat, acknowledged the bank official's farewells, and tapped on the chauffeur's window. As they pulled away, Ruby Lance slipped her hand through his arm and squeezed it.
"Did you get it?"
she asked. Benedict grinned happily.
"I frightened 5 years' growth out of old Larson. He almost broke his neck in the hurry to give it to me."
"Now you've got it all,"
Ruby snuggled a little closer to him on the soft leather upholstery. Benedict nodded and checked his watch.
"The meeting's set for 15 minutes' time. I'll go up the front way, but I want you to go up in the private lift from the basement garage and wait in my office. We'll be in the boardroom. I'll ring you at the right moment."
The Rolls picked its way slowly down around the Herengracht and double-parked outside the building. The chauffeur came to open the door, but before he alighted, Benedict smiled into Ruby's face.
"This'll be one of the high moments of my life," he said softly. "This time I've got the bastard cold."
"I'll be waiting for you,"
Ruby said, and he climbed out of the Rolls.
He waited until it had turned into the entrance ramp of the basement garage. Then he crossed the pavement into the main lobby of the skyscraper. He strode to the elevator with long, eager strides, and his mouth kept pulling into a small, excited smile. The boardroom was set high, and the picture windows looked up at the great squat mountain whose sheer cliffs dropped directly to the wooded slopes up which the first buildings of the city straggled. Johnny Lance stood at the head of the table. He had lost weight in the last few days, so that his shoulders appeared bony and gaunt under the white silk shirt. He had discarded his jacket and pulled the knot of his tie down an inch. The bones of his cheeks and jaw were made harsh angles that were accentuated and not softened by the deep shades of fatigue that darkened his eyes. His hands were thrust deep into his pockets, and he spoke without reference to the sheaf of paper that lay on the table before him. "Our working costs are as close as, damn it, to £100 an hour. Right, Mike?" And Michael Shapiro nodded. "Well, we worked the suicide main gully for 66 hours, and we recovered a princely 200 carats of the lousiest pile of junk I've ever seen. If we get £1,000 for the lost, we'll be doing well. This for an expenditure of £6,500. Johnny paused and looked around the table. Michael Shapiro was doodling on his notepad with fierce concentrations. Tracy van der Bael was pale. Her eyes never left Johnny's face, and her expression ached with pity and helpless compassion. Benedict van der Bael was looking out of the window at the mountain. He was slumped comfortably in his chair, smiling a little and listening politely. "The suicide main gully is one of the five most likely parts of the entire concession. It's no good, so the rest of the field may be useless. We have the two other concessions, the original fields, to try. However, it'll take 3 or 4 days to get Kingfisher moved up the coast." Johnny paused, and Benedict swiveled his chair, still with a small smile on his lips. "The interest payments fall due on the 30th, 3 days' time. Where are you going to find 150,000 rands? "Yes," Johnny nodded, "I think I can persuade Larson to extend for a few weeks. He'll bloody well have to, if he wants to protect his..." "Hold on," Benedict murmured. "Larson has got nothing to do with it." Johnny was silent, watching him warily. "Explain," he invited. "I've taken over the loan from Larson," Benedict told him. "I'm not interested in extending." "Larson wouldn't have negotiated without warning me." Johnny was stricken. His disclaimer was wrung from him in pain. "Shapiro?" Benedict turned to Michael Shapiro for confirmation. "Sorry, Johnny, it's true. I've seen the documents." "Thanks, Michael." Johnny's voice was bitter with accusations. "Thanks for letting me know." "He showed me a few minutes before the meeting, Johnny. I swear I didn't know." Michael's expression was distressed. "Right," Benedict straightened up in his chair. His voice was brisk. "Let's get down to first principles. You've ruined my father's company, Lance. But thank God I may be able to retrieve the situation. Call it sentiment or what you like, but I want your shares and yours." He turned to Tracy and nodded at her. "No," said Tracy sharply. "Right," Benedict smiled at her. "Then I'm going to hammer Johnny Lance for his full obligations. That way I get the company anyway. But I'll make damn sure he remains an unrehabilitated bankrupt for the rest of his life." Tracy lifted her hand to her throat and turned her eyes to Johnny, waiting for him to set a lead. There was a long, stark silence. Then Johnny Lance dropped his eyes. "I've still got 3 days." His voice was gruff and tired. 3 days you have," Benedict grinned coldly. "And you're welcome to them." Johnny picked up his papers and put them under one arm. He took his jacket off the back of the chair and swung it over his shoulder. "Wait," ordered Benedict. "What for?" Johnny's grin was twisted. "You've had your fun." Benedict lifted the receiver of the telephone on the table and dialed swiftly. "Come through, please, darling," he spoke into the mouthpiece and smiled at Johnny as he hung up. Then, as the door opened, he went to meet Ruby Lance and kissed her on the mouth. The two of them stood arm in arm and looked at Johnny. "The company's not the only thing I've taken from you," Benedict said softly. "I want a divorce," Ruby looked steadily into Johnny's face. "Benedict and I are going to get married." They were all watching Johnny, and they saw him flinch. He looked from one face to the other, then his mouth tightened and his forehead furrowed. Tracy saw his anger mounting, and her eyes flicked to Benedict's face. He was leaning forward expectantly, his lips quivering with expectation, his eyes alight with triumph. Tracy wanted to scream out a warning to Johnny, stop him falling into the trap that Benedict had set so carefully. Johnny took a pace forward, coming up onto the balls of his feet. He was about to make his defeat total and ineradicable. Then Benedict spoiled it for himself. He goaded once more. "Game, set, and match, Johnny Lance," he crowed. The effort of will that Johnny made to recover his reason was not shown on his face. He made the step forward seem natural and continued towards the door. "The house is in your name, of course, Ruby, so would you please send my things down to the Toolbach Hotel?" he asked quietly. He stopped in front of the couple and spoke to Ruby. "You'll want to protect your reputation, of course, so I'll not sue for adultery. We'll call it desertion."
"You're eating your guts out," jeered Benedict. "Lance can't keep his woman. Thunder Bale took her away from him. Go on, sue for adultery. Let the world hear it."
"As you wish," Johnny agreed. And he walked out of the boardroom to the elevators. Johnny flopped onto the bed fully dressed and rubbed his closed eyes with his fingertips. He felt confused and off balance. The edge of his mind, which usually slashed quickly and incisively through a problem, was dulled. This problem was so multiplied and tangled that he felt like a man in a thicket of African ebony trying to cut his way out with a blunt machete. Without opening his eyes, he groped for the telephone, and the girl on the hotel switchboard downstairs answered. He gave her a number in Kimberley. "Person to person, Mr. Ralph Ellison." 15 minutes delay, Mr. Lance," the girl told him.
"Okay,"
Johnny replied. "Ask room service to send me up a Chivas Regal and soda." He suddenly needed liquor, something to dull the pain. "Make that a double, honey. No, make it two doubles." He had drained both glasses by the time his Kimberley call came through. "Ralph," Johnny spoke into the receiver.
"Johnny, how nice of you to call."
There was an echo like distant laughter beneath those cool ambassadorial tones in Ralph Ellison's voice, and Johnny knew instantly that the word was out. Damn it, he was slow. Of course, Benedict would have blocked him.
"Are you still interested in a deal on the Thunderbolt and Suicide concession?"
Johnny loosed a despairing long-range shot.
"Of course, you know we're always interested," Ralph replied. "The price is 2 million.
Johnny lost interest and lay back on the bed, closing his eyes again. He knew Ralph was having his revenge. You didn't take this boy to court and win without sowing yourself a minefield to retreat over.
2 million, Ralph murmured. "Now that's a little high for a field that's yielding 200 carats of small industrial diamonds per 10,000 loads. That's definitely on the high side. Of course, we wouldn't want that battleship of yours either. We're not starting our own navy," Ralph chuckled juicily. "We could talk around 50 to 100 grand. No more than that, Johnny."
"Okay, Ralph," Johnny spoke warily. "Thanks all the same. We'll have a drink together sometime."
"Any time, Johnny," Ralph agreed. "Any time at all. You call me."
Johnny dropped the receiver back on its hook and looked at the ceiling. He had heard that a gunshot wound was numb at first. He felt numb now. All that energy had seeped out of him. He had lost direction. The telephone shrilled and he picked it up. The girl on the switchboard asked politely,
"Are you finished, Mr. Lance?"
"Yes," said Johnny. "You might say that."
"Is there anything else you require?" The girl sounded puzzled.
"Yes, honey, send up the hemlock."
"I beg your pardon?"
2 more big fat whiskies, please."
He drank them in the bath, and while he dried himself, the doorbell tinkled. He wound the bath towel round his waist and went through to open the door. Tracy stepped into the bedroom and closed the door behind her. They stood looking at each other for a long moment. Her eyes were dark and big, reflecting his agony faithfully.
"Johnny."
Her voice was husky, and she reached out and laid the palm of her hand on his cheek. His shoulders sagged, and he moved close to her, his forehead sinking onto her shoulder. He sighed, a ragged, broken exhalation of breath.
"Come," she said, and led him to the bed.
Leaving him there, she went to the windows and closed the curtains. It was warm and safe in the half-dark of the curtained room, and they held each other as they had done long years before, clinging together so their breathing mingled, and it was not necessary to speak. When they became lovers, it seemed that they had waited all their lives for that moment. Afterwards, he lay in her arms, and he felt strength flowing back into him, drawing it from her. When he sat up in the bed, the bemused, almost dazed expression had gone. His jaw was out and his eyes were bright.
"We've still got 3 days, he said.
Yes, she sat up beside him. Go, Johnny, go quickly. Don't waste another moment. I'll pull Kingfisher out of the main gully. I'll find those diamonds. They are there, I know they're there. I'll take her right down into the jaws of Thunderbolt and Suicide. I'll find those bloody diamonds. Damned if I won't. He swung his legs off the bed, reached for his clothes, glancing at his wristwatch as he did so. 4 o'clock. I can get to Cartridge Bay a few minutes after dark. Will you call the communications office, ask them to radio Cartridge Bay, and have a flare path set for me, and Wild Goose standing by to run me out? I'll phone them from here. Then I'll take a bath. You go on. Don't waste time. Tracy nodded eagerly, and Johnny let his eyes drop down over her body. He reached out and touched one big white breast almost diffidently. You're beautiful. I hate to go. It will all be here waiting for you when you get back. It wasn't the way I planned it. It wasn't good the way I dreamed about it. Benedict paced angrily over the floor of the old man's study, swinging towards the windows and pausing to stare out at the mountain across the valley. You hurt him. You crushed him. Ruby moved restlessly in her chair across the room from him, curling her long golden legs defensively under her, sitting like a cat in the big chair. She was worried, and it showed in the tiny crow's feet at the corners of her eyes, and the way she held her lips pursed. She should have anticipated this reaction from him. She should have known that this moment of triumph could never match his anticipation of it, and that revenge must always be followed by sour distaste and a feeling of disappointment. She realized that her safest course was to leave him alone now. She should never have returned with him to the old house on Weinberg Hill. She stood up. Darling, she crossed to him, I'm going home now. I want to pack his clothes and get rid of them. I want to wipe out every memory of him. From now on, it's you and I, together. She stretched up to kiss him, but Benedict turned his face away. Oh, so you're going, are you? His expression was petulant, his lips pouting spitefully. We're both tired, darling. Let's both rest a while, and I'll come back later this evening. So now you're giving the orders, are you? He laughed nastily. Darling? And cut out all the darlings. We pulled a deal and it didn't work out. You were meant to be a club to break his skull. And do you know something? He didn't give a damn. I was watching him. He was pleased. Yeah. He was bloody well delighted to get rid of you. Benedict, she stepped back. Listen, he stepped close to her and pushed his face towards hers. If you're so bloody anxious to go, why don't you bloody well go and keep going? If he doesn't want you, then I sure as hell don't want you either. Benedict, she whispered. The colour faded from her face, leaving it washed white as beach sand. She stared at him in horror, as her dreams began to fall into ruins around her. You don't mean that. I don't? Is that so? He threw back his head and laughed again. Ha! Listen! You got some nice diamonds and a mink coat. You got a big house in Bishop's Court. Now that's pretty good pay for a whore. Benedict, she gasped at the insult, but he wasn't listening. I proved I could have you, didn't I? I proved I could take you away from him, and that's what it was all about. Now, why don't you just go home like a good little girl? The machine. I know about that thing in Kingfisher. It was a mistake. Until then, she still had a chance. His face changed shape, and the blood flooded into it. His voice, when he spoke, was unsteady, thick with rage, for his lips seemed to have swollen. Try it, he whispered back at her. Go on, try it. They'll give you 15 years in a woman's prison, my beauty. And think about this also. He showed her his hand, holding it like a blade before her eyes. I'll kill you. I swear before God, I'll kill you with my bare hands. You know I'll do it. You know enough about me now. She backed away from him, and he followed her, still holding his hand at her throat. You've been paid. Now get out. A few seconds longer, she stood before him. And he was not too far gone in rage to see the fear in her eyes mingle with something else that made her eyes slit and drew her lips back to show the little white teeth. All right, she said, I'll go. And she walked from the room, stepping daintily, the long yellow hair swinging against her shoulders. Ruby drove slowly, for her vision was blurred with her tears. Twice other drivers hooted at her, but she kept both hands clenched on the wheel and stared ahead, following the Duval Drive around the lower slopes of the mountain. Before she reached the university, she swung off the road and drove up through the pine forests
until she reached the car park behind the Cecil Rhodes Memorial. She left the car and walked down onto the wide paved terrace below the Greek columns and stone steps where the mounted statue eternally searched the horizon with one hand lifted to shade his eyes. She went to the parapet and looked across to the far blue mountains of the Helderberg. She hugged herself about the shoulders, for the wind through her silk summer dress was as cold as her misery. Now the tears broke over her lids and slid down her cheeks to fall unheeded on the silken front of her dress. They were tears of self-pity, but also the tears of an anger as searing cold as dry ice. "The swine," she whispered, through lips that trembled. Near her, two young students sitting on the parapet, kicking their legs over the drop beneath them, and hugging each other in the abandon of first love, turned to glance at her. The boy whispered to the girl, and she giggled in unthinking cruelty, but looked away as Ruby directed a long, venomous glare at her. Then, in embarrassment, the couple scrambled off the parapet and moved away, leaving her alone. Never for one moment did she consider standing aside. Benedict's threats meant nothing. Her only concern was to take the action which would injure him most severely. The consequences to herself were not part of her calculations. She wanted only to select the swiftest and most terrible vehicle of retribution. As the dark clouds that fogged her reason slowly cleared, the means came to her readily. Johnny was staying at the Tulbach Hotel. She turned and ran back to her car, the long yellow banner of her hair flowing behind her like the pennant at the tip of a cavalry lance. She drove fast until she hit the downtown rush hour crowds. The tears dried on her face as she crawled, fuming with impatience, along the slow river of traffic. It was after 5 when she parked in a loading zone outside the entrance to the Tulbach and ran into the lobby. "What room is Mr. Lance in?" she demanded of the girl at the desk. "Mr. Lance checked out an hour ago." Curiously, the girl examined Ruby's ruined makeup. "Did he say where he was going?" Ruby snapped at her, feeling the sickening slide of disappointment within her. "No, madam." The girl shook her head. "But he was in a hurry." "Damn, damn!" Ruby swore bitterly. She turned from the desk, undecided where next to look. Perhaps Johnny had gone back to the office. Across the lobby, the elevator doors slid open, and Tracy Hartford stepped out. Even in her impatience, Ruby recognized in the glow that seemed to emanate from her that Tracy was a girl freshly risen from the bed of the man she loved. There was not a vestige of doubt in Ruby's mind as to the identity of that man. The shock of it paralyzed her for a moment. Then she felt the urge to cross the floor and claw the smug smile from Tracy's face. She fought it down, and instead she stepped into her path as Tracy started for the glass outer doors. "Where's Johnny?" she demanded, and Tracy came up short. Her little gasp of guilt confirmed Ruby's suspicion. "Where is he, damn you?" Ruby's voice was pitched low, but brittle with emotion. "He's not here," Tracy recovered herself, quickly masking her expression. "Where's he gone? I must see him. He's flown up to Cartridge Bay." "When did he leave? It's important, terribly important." "An hour ago. He'll be airborne already." "Can you get a message to him?" In her impatience, Ruby caught Tracy's wrist, holding her in a grip that marked the skin. "I can radio him." Tracy pulled her hand free. "No," Ruby cut in quickly. She could not have her message shouted across the ether for all to hear. "Can you follow him? Charter a plane?" Tracy shook her head. "They won't fly to an unscheduled airfield after dark." "Then you must follow him, by car. You must drive up there." "Why?" Tracy stared at her, puzzled by the strange insistence, noticing the dried tears and the wild look in Ruby's eyes. "It's an 8-hour drive. I'll tell you. Can we use Johnny's room?" Tracy hesitated, remembering the unmade bed. Then the hotel manager came into the lobby, and Tracy turned to him with relief.